Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, October the 9th, 2025, and this is episode 3,745 of the podcast. So that means I get to end a week because I don't work Fridays anymore, finally, after, what did I do, 16 years of 5 days a week for cutting back to four. But I like to end weeks on fives, or zeros, either one. And now that we have, 4 days a week, it doesn't always work out that way, even if you get it to happen once or twice. But today it did. So I know I'm just a weirdo that I like numbers like that, but that's just who I am. What do we got today? Chris Rossini and Dan McAdams are going to, not Dan McAdams, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul are actually going to talk about Trump. And is he going to drop a new stimulus check? And if so, what does it mean? And how bad an idea is it? I'll give you my thoughts on it. You might be surprised at my thoughts when I give you my thoughts on it. But maybe you won't be surprised after you hear my reason after I talk about it. Anyway, then we're going to talk with Andy McCann today. He's going to talk about dealing with a combination of Crohn's and UC, or ulcerative colitis, something he knows a lot about because his son had to deal with Crohn's. Joel Riles will talk about training multiple dogs to work and obey together. Not so much as a team here is what I mean, though. It's more like when I tell Belle to sit, and I say, Belle, sit, she sits. Lucy doesn't care. What happens when you've trained your dogs really well, but when you give a command like sit, both dogs sit. Maybe I don't want both dogs to sit. Maybe one dog needs to sit. Maybe the other dog needs to be doing something else. We need dogs to understand not only what the command is, but when the command is being directed at them, at their, co-pet, or maybe at everybody. It's actually good that you can make all the dogs sit at one time, but it doesn't necessarily mean you always want it to be that way, Next up today, Patrick Rohrman will talk about the fact that you have a lifetime to learn, so be patient, but also get going, and you get better with repetition, so the time to start your repetition is now. This is another one where Patrick has taken a concept of sharpening and bridged the gap into other parts of life. I'm really digging what Patrick's been doing lately. Ryan Steva will talk about rehabbing an older solar mobile backup power system, right? He's going to call it something that is being marketed heavily now. And even though this, the one he's talking about doing here, it was actually made before the term was introduced by marketers, that is solar generator. I'm going to ask a question when Ryan's done today. What should we call these things? I do not believe calling them solar generators is a proper use of the language. I think it is nothing but marketing fluff. A generator, well, we'll talk about it when we get there. But it's not a generator. It's a small-scale solar system. All right, backup solar power, something like that, okay? And then is there anything to parasite cleanses, or are they BS? We'll talk to Doc Bones about that. And then I've got a segment for you guys. I just thought about, what's going on in the world right now that's not part of the news, like just for homesteaders. And what's happening is things are changing. J.R. Haley was at our place this week, and he stayed over last night. And this morning, Dorothy and I and he sat out on our back porch and had coffee for about a two-hour conversation before we left. That's why the show for a Thursday anyway is a bit late going out today because I got a late start because of that. But I was sitting there talking to my wife and my friend, and I started thinking about, 2 weeks ago, even in the morning, we wouldn't have sat out here for 2 hours. Maybe first thing, ass crack of dawn for about 30 minutes. But then you would have been like, it's sticky, nasty. And we were sitting out there, this is beautiful. Now, it's still going to be very warm today. It'll probably be close to 90 degrees for the high today. But the evenings are cool, and the mornings are cool. And for many of you, you would have had a flannel shirt or a light jacket on, or maybe even a little bit more if you were sitting on your back porch at 6:30 this morning. What does that mean? Old man winter is not here, but he is on the way. He is coming. And that means that we're straight off into fall. September 21st was the first day officially of fall. We're on October 9th. We're cranking. We're heading toward, Halloween and then Thanksgiving and the holidays. Like, we're heading to winter. And most of you, many of you anyway, have gardens. I'm going to talk to you guys today about what to be doing with your garden. And I want to say now, but I don't really mean now. Everything is dependent upon where you are in the world and what state your garden's in. Like, my garden's in ass state right now. I'm like burning off grass and weeds, and I'll tell you what I'm doing when we get to the segment. But that's because my chickens went rogue this year and literally destroyed my garden. I got almost no production this year. I got to a point where I got frustrated, said the hell with it, and I let it go for the year. I basically watered it to keep the soil healthy, and whatever grew, we still got some stuff, but nothing like usual. Like, it was kind of a wash a bit this year. And I want to have a great year next year, so I'm getting ready to do that. So when I say what to do with your garden heading to winter, what I'm saying is if you're not doing a fall/winter garden, what if you're going to be done for the year like I am? Like, what do you do? There's a lot of things to do, but none of it's hard. And I actually, as much as I enjoy gardening late into the season, I actually really like this approach. Because it's just one thing that you just, like, okay, we're done with that. We're going to put it to bed, and it's going to wake up in spring, and we'll reboot the whole system, and we'll make it even better while it sleeps. It'll get a good rest. The big thing is we won't have anything to do. We're going to take a break, especially heading into the holidays, because I love the holidays. So I'm coming at it from that approach. I've grown fall gardens. I've grown winter gardens. I've grown all, you know, season round before. In fact, in Texas, honestly, it's easier to grow in early spring and late fall than it is in summer. But yet it doesn't mean that it's not a good time for a break. So this will be a macro level view. I mean, I could do a whole show on just this topic. It'll be a 10 to 15 minute segment. But it will be the highlights of the things that if you are like, the garden is done for the year, or soon will be. These are the things that you need to do, a little checklist you can run through. And when you're done with that, you'll know that your spring will be easy, and your garden will be ready to be better than ever. With that in mind, let's go ahead and remind you that one of the ways you can help our show is to join the Member Support Brigade. That is the MSB, or Member Support Brigade. And if you join that, it's $50 a year. You can look at all the discounts you get. If you take and use 4 or 5 discounts a year, you will get your money back plus. Just on that. There are some discounts that one purchase will put all your money back into your pocket. There's seeds, like we're talking about today. There's tactical stuff. There's garden stuff, right? There's precious metals. If you buy precious metals, there's a discount on precious metals. There's discount on cannabis products. There's discounts on tons of different things. Mushroom spawn. I have 2 different mushroom vendors that you can get discounts from. And again, those discounts, if you grow mushrooms, will pay for your entire membership plus. I hear from people all the time saying, I make $200 to $300 a year in profit after I get my money back with your membership program. So if you're not a member yet, consider becoming one. And also consider picking up a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirko. I wrote that book because I feel a sense of obligation to basically everybody in this audience, and anybody that will listen to me. I feel grateful that anybody will pay attention to me. But there's a specific segment of demographic that I feel most needs to hear what's in this book. And those are people from the age of about 15 to 35. Again, if you're 50, I think you'll love the book. I think it'll help you a lot. But I think, man, if somebody said to me, what would you tell 21-year-old Jack Spirko right out of the military about what to do with his life? I've always answered that question with, I wouldn't tell him anything because I wouldn't want to derail anything. You know, I wouldn't want to change the timeline or whatever. But if I had to do something, rather than saying, hey, go buy this or go do that, I would take this very book. Hopefully, it wouldn't really work for me because it's about me. But a book just like mine with these laws in it. I would give myself the 16 laws of life in this book with a brief explanation of each one. I really would. This is like the when they say write a letter to yourself when you were 20, this is the letter I would have written. If you want to infuse somebody young in your life with the knowledge of how to build their life on their terms, this book is for you. Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by me, myself, and I, Jack Spirko. With that, let's go ahead and get things cranked up here today. With leading off with Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini on Trump and a stimulus round? A round of stimulus checks right now? Are you kidding me? Really? Is that what the Orange Man's going to do?
The fact that President Trump is bringing up stimulus checks again is really something else. It's an eye-catcher because, as you point out, that CARES Act was such a disaster in the effects of it. And that's what Thomas Massie was fighting He was alone, I remember, and Trump's calling him a third-rate grandstander. Massey is pointing out this is going to create massive inflation. It's exactly what happened. We are suffering from the same inflation today. That's how long. Now, Biden added fuel to the fire. We won't forget that. But President Trump is the one that lit the inferno with the massive inflation, and now here he comes again with more stimulus checks that he's proposing. First of all, if everything is so great, what do we need stimulus for? It's because we all know it's not great, you know, and President Trump says inflation is dead, and we all know inflation is not dead. And how can you give rebates or checks when you don't have money yourself? The federal government is running record deficits. They don't have the money. It's not like they have a pile of money. Look at all these surpluses. Let's give some back to the people. No, they're borrowing and printing money. And that means that they're going to have to borrow and print money to give us these stimulus checks, which mean one thing: higher prices, more inflation. It's more of a tax on us. So the whole thing is terrible. It's a continuation of his terrible policy from the first administration. So I guess, in a sense, we shouldn't be too surprised.
A couple good members of Congress, especially Thomas Massie, was really being hammered by the administration and the president. And he was the worst person in the world. I got to get rid of this guy. His sin was he followed the Constitution better than anybody else in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And he has to be taken out. And, of course, that's a soft but taken out of the Congress. So that is so disappointing. And yet we have the same disappointment of the administration. The foreign policy we're not happy with, and the spending especially we're not happy with. But this is something that we need, freedom of information, spreading information on all ideas, whether it's economic policy, foreign policy, or whatever. The government is not supposed to be there to tell us how to live. It's there to let us live our own lives and develop a system of understanding what self-sovereignty means.
Here's the part where I say something that surprises you. And some of you are thinking, I know what he's going to say, and I think I'm going to surprise you too. I don't give a shit. See, half of you are like, well, since he said it, we're going to be surprised, then he's going to be like, go ahead, do it. Nah, yeah, I don't give a shit if you do it or don't. But here's the big reason I don't give a shit. They're not going to do it. This is nonsense. This is, we're going to invade Greenland. Canada's going to be the 51st state. I've learned that when Trump says stupid shit, that's not going to happen, to ignore it. Which is about half of what comes out of his mouth is never going to happen. Why does he do this? I don't effing know. He's got a couple of congressional surrogates that are out there mouthing off about it's a nice distraction from the shutdown that nobody gives a fuck about. I don't know. I'm not worried about it. Here's how I feel about it at this point. It's going to make inflation worse. I don't care. Everything's going to make inflation worse. The dollar is dying. We are too heavy in debt. Yeah, and more won't matter. It's going to fucking die anyway. I don't care. If they send me a $2,000 check, I'll put it straight into Bitcoin. I won't even think about it. It'll be like, in my account, straight over to Strike, boom, purchase. I'll probably do it over like a month or something. Daily, add to my daily purchase enough to dispose of extra $2,000 this month. That's it. That's all I'll do. I don't give a fuck. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter first and foremost because it is highly unlikely to happen. So when something, like somebody says something, doesn't mean the thing is going to be. Right. So somebody says something like, well, there could be a giant storm this winter. It might really hit Minneapolis. Okay, that could happen. But you're not going to start freaking out if you live in Minneapolis over a winter storm, are you? You have them all the time anyway. It doesn't really matter. And it probably won't be any worse than any other storm. And how would the fuck would somebody know it's going to happen in October by saying it's going to happen? See what I mean? You just go, oh, okay, sure. And then you keep an eye on the weather, and if it looks like it's actually going to happen, then you... But until you have some reason to believe the thing will occur, you don't care. right? You don't care at all. Now, I completely agree with them about Massey. But let me tell you what else my opinion is. Well, Trump is going to put all these people together and try to get Massey voted out of office. I also don't care. And why don't I care? Because then Trump will lose again. He'll be 0-3 against Massey. So I don't care. Because Thomas Massey's not going anywhere. Thomas Massey is loved in his district. There is no way they are unseating him. So I don't care. See, and this is the only reason I'm commenting at the end of this segment. It's not about what Chris and Ron had to say or my opinion of them or anything negative like that at all. I'm just saying there's so much people are caring about that doesn't fucking affect your life. The temperature of the water in your pool will not change over this. He's not going to do it. He's not going to do it. He's not going to do it. What he's going to do is say he wants to do it, and then he's going to claim the Democrats prevented it. Why do I know that? The pattern is set. Right. And if he does do it, I still don't care. Oh, my God, inflation. Oh, my God, inflation. You see what I'm saying? Like, do you really think this matters at this point? Do you think that, there is no fixing this? So there's no reason to be upset about it anymore. What you do now is carve out your life your way on your terms. If the government is stupid enough to hand you money, the smart thing to do with it is to buy something with it that has lasting value that will appreciate in value over time as quickly as possible. And just see it as the found money that it is. That's what you do. That's what you do. All right. And it ain't freaking happening. Canada will be the 51st state, I believe, before this happens. It's a tariff rebate or whatever. All he's trying to do is make you feel that his tariffs are good. Whether you believe that or not, also doesn't matter to me because it won't affect the water in my pool at all. Now let's hear from Andy McCann on Crohn's disease and UC.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. You can find me at CrossFitGarage.com. Or you can follow us at garagefitness.online. And I'm doing a couple of back-to-back episodes right here because I am volunteering at D&D in a Castle in Ohio. It's going to be awesome. All right. I have a question here from Zach. He basically says his 16-year-old got diagnosed with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Woo! That's a tough one to say. And he was asking, what episodes do Evan and I talk about his Crohn's and his journey? And then he mentions that they're getting the house ready to do a keto, lion diet, or paleo diet. So I'm going to give some information on that. First off, guys, do not do this alone. I'm going to go down a different road than I went down before because I feel like I just answered this question a little bit ago. The episodes that we've got on food, fitness, and finance are these. It's 140, that's the part one, and then 141 is part two. 159 is part three of his journey, and then 168 is part four. Evan and I are going to do another episode before he goes back to college. And here's the thing that I really want to throw out to you, Zach, and anybody else dealing with this. One, don't go it alone. We did use the Lion Diet for about 4 months before we saw any change in Evan's ability to kind of like, I guess not change. At 4 months, it really... we noticed a big change. So there was a slow progress of being able to control the bathroom urges and throwing up and all that once we went to the Lion Diet. Here's the thing that I'm going to tell you. Do it together as a family, or at least you do it with him. It is super lonely to be on this road of Crohn's and any irritable bowel syndrome. Evan is at college, or was at college. Right now he is home doing an internship as a computer science major, which now we're sharing an office because he's here working right next to me, so it's been great. We enjoy each other's company, and we've been doing a lot of work together, and I am going down the road with him and get to see and hear his emotional well-being and how he's processing. While he was at school and he was up there by himself, the college kids don't understand. And it's impossible to ask them to understand anything else except beer, books, and, you know, babes or whatever. It's just hard for them to grasp what's going on. So go with your kid because no one else will. I did ask Evan beforehand, hey, would you be willing to talk to any kids out there going through this? And he said yes. So email me, call me, text me, whatever. My phone number and my email address is all over my website. It's actually me. You call or text, you get directly to me. So go to my website, find it. Hit me with some information. Do not let them go alone. That is probably the hardest part. Well, I mean, obviously the weight loss and all that, but just the emotional strain is super tough. So I am excited that you're willing to do this for them. Not many people would. I know you're thinking, well, wait, it's my kid. Why wouldn't I do it? I mean, I hear you, but the call of sugar And the slavery we have to our tongue is so immense that it's tough. I mean, you could ask Evan. He's over there doing his thing right now. If he yelled out, do I cheat on this diet? No. Because he needs somebody to understand. So do it with him. That is awesome. I would start on the lion diet. We got a lot of success out of that. That's a Michaela Peterson thing that she's doing. That's Jordan Peterson's daughter. We also used the gutsolution.ca. It's Josh Detch's group. And he specializes in this stuff. And is it worth your time and money? I don't know. We found success with it. I am excited that you're doing it with her. And I'm sad that you have to do it with her. Evan and I were talking about this on the way out the other day. And I said, it's kind of abnormal this stuff is happening. He's like, Dad, it's not. Now that I'm here, there are so many people with a story that started off with, hey, I'm a teenager, or I just got to college, and dot, dot, dot. And here I am. So, guys, don't go alone. The lion diet is a great way to go. Doing keto or paleo is probably good as well, but I would start in the lion diet, which is ruminant meat, salt, and water. And then, text us, call us, email us. The toughest part is being heard and knowing that somebody else understands. So do that with them. I think that is awesome. Zach, take care. If you need me, I think I emailed you my number, so give me a call anytime.
All right, great stuff as always from Andy. I think I really made some good decisions about some removals of the piker tree from the expert council toward the beginning of this year, along with the addition of some new folks. Andy being one of those additions has just been an absolute home run for this audience and this community and the show as a whole. Moving on, let's talk about another relatively new member of the council, not quite as new as all the folks that came on in the last year, but Joel Riles, who's been a good friend of the show and a good friend of myself and Dorothy for a long time. He's got a great segment today on dogs, of course. That's what you expect from Joel. But it's also about something I think is really prevalent in this audience. Most of us don't own a dog. We own dogs. Very few people own one dog. It's just something about, like, you like to have another one for them to play with or whatever. And then you train them, and then you say sit, and both dogs sit at the same time. It's not always what you're looking for. So how do you train multiple dogs so the right dog does what you want when you ask it to do it?
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again. And today we're going to talk about how to start working multiple dogs. So if you have more than one dog and you are trying to work obedience, you need to let each dog know when you're talking to them or when you're not talking to them. And a lot of people really struggle with this. I just had a client who has two of our dogs, and she's trying to get them to do different things, and she asked for me to give her a rundown on exactly how to build this up so that as she's working each dog, they don't both respond. She made the mistake of having them both just respond to commands, right? Let's go. They both come running. Wait. They both wait. But now she's wanting to start doing things with one dog and having the other dog do something different, and she was really struggling with that. So I walked her through it. There's actually a 15-minute video up on our YouTube channel with one of the drills that I did with her, but I wanted to do a step-by-step process with you guys so that if you have more than one dog and you're trying to get them to do commands by name individually and not always doing the same thing, this is how we go through it. All right, step one is we start with what I call table drills. All this is some kind of platform off the ground. It could be the back of a pickup truck, drop the tailgate, put them both up on the tailgate, and work them there. It could be an actual table. It could be some kind of other platform. It needs to be big enough that they can comfortably lay and sit and lay and sit. But it doesn't need to be gigantic. You want them off the ground a little bit for two reasons. One is it adds just a little bit of stress to most dogs. And the obedience drill that we're going to be working actually reduces that stress that they're feeling while they're up there. So we call that one stress relieves the other. You can use a mild stressor when you're introducing something new to a dog, and it actually helps them learn it faster because the stress of the new thing that they're learning actually relieves the stress that they're under and vice versa, and it progresses their training a little faster. Okay, so how do we do a table exercise? So The other reason I'm using this table is so that I'm not leaning over, getting out of position myself, and I can stay close to both dogs as they're getting used to you do one thing, you do another thing, right? So I'm going to put both the dogs up on the table. Now, this is assuming that both dogs have a basic understanding of obedience to begin with, right? I'm not going to be introducing seats to two dogs at once. I'm going to introduce seats, which is to sit down one at a time. Once they understand what seats means, then I can bring them together and do it together, right? I'm going to introduce plots, which is to lay down. I'm going to introduce that one at a time, make sure that they know it well, then I can do it together. So I'm not introducing commands in this setting. What I'm introducing is you do X, you seats, you plots, right? And so I put them both up on this table so I can literally stand, you know, pretty much right next to the table like I would be right now if I had two dogs up here on this table with me. And I have one lead for each dog in each hand, and I'm going to do a lot of lead directing the first couple of times I do this, right? So let's say, you know, I've got Princess and Killer, and I go Killer seats, and I direct up with the lead for Killer. Killer good seats, Princess good plots. Now, if Princess starts to seats when I'm directing Killer up, I'm just going to use the lead and bump her back down into her position, right? And then I'm going to praise her when she's plotting. Good plots, Princess. Killer good seats. Okay, Killer plots, and I'm going to direct Killer down into a plots. Princess seats, and I'm going to direct Princess up into a seats. If Killer tries to get up into a seats, I just bump him down. And I want to randomize this, though. I don't want it to be you up, then down, then up, then down, right? I want it to be up, up, down, up, down, down, up. I just mix it up, right? I don't want to start setting patterns when I do this because the dogs just start following the patterns rather than actually listening. But that's how I'm going to start this off. It's going to be basic sit, plutz drills, so sit and lay down. And the key here is you're going to start introducing a preparatory command. So in the military, certain commands while you're marching are preparatory commands. What that means is I'm getting ready to tell you to do something, so be ready, now do it, right? And so the preparatory command for the dog is their name. Now, here's one important thing. Never make the dog's name a recall, because if you have multiple dogs and you're trying to get a dog that's at a distance to jump up on a platform and you say their name and you've made their name a recall, they come running to you and now you've got to walk all the way back out there and put them where they're supposed to be, right? So as I start to work these drills, I say their name. All I want them to do when they hear their name is to look at me and pay attention. And then they get the command to do whatever it is and then they do it. Right. So I don't want them, when I say their name, I don't want them jumping off the table. Right. Because if I take like one step away from the table, they might be tempted to jump off the table and come to me. I don't want them to start associating their name with a command or especially a recall. I only want them to associate their name with pay attention. I'm about to tell you something to do. Now, another thing that you may have to start doing, and especially as you begin adding distance into this, is you need to give both dogs commands every time. So what I typically do is the dog that I do not want to follow the command, I go, Princess, good plots. Princess, you wait. Killer, seats. Right? And so I'm letting her know she's doing a good job. Stay where you are. You sit. And then I'll go, Killer, good seats. Killer, you wait. Princess, seats. Okay? And so you have to start including their names. Now, when you have multiple dogs, one of the things you can do that's not a problem is you can still give group commands without their names. Just understand that whenever you give the group command, you expect everybody to do it. When I give a specific dog by name a command, then I only want that dog to do it, right? And then as you do this, we start moving on to the ground. Once they're on the ground, weight commands and things like that are a little bit more challenging, but if you're working your downstay exercises on the ground already, this shouldn't be too much of a problem. And then you can start recalling them one at a time. So you put them in like a downstay about 10 or 15 feet away from you. They're separated a little bit on the ground, about 15 feet from each other. And you go, Killer, good plots. Killer, you wait. Princess, let's go. Good go, good go. Now, what do you do if when you start doing that particular part of the exercise and they both come running to you? What I do is I ignore the dog that came when they were not supposed to. Because our recalls, I want strong recalls for my dogs, right? So our recalls are good, go, good, go, good, go when they come in, and then they get lots of petting. Oh, good, go, good, go, good, go, right? Now, when I'm doing multiple dogs, especially when I'm first starting multiple dogs, I'm gonna praise the dog for coming, but I'm gonna try and keep it a little more calm and a little more quiet so I'm not tempting the other dog if they waited. So if that dog waited, I call this dog in, good, go, good, go, good, go, seats. And then killer, let's go. You know, killer, good, wait. Killer, let's go. They come in, good, go, killer, good, go. I reset the exercise and do it again. And I'm going to mix up who I call first, right? I might call one and then walk them back and put them back and then come over and then call that one again and then walk and put them back and come over and then call the other dog, right? I'm mixing it up. So sometimes I'll call them in one at a time. Sometimes I'll call them in both at the same time. Sometimes I'll call one in and put them back and then call the other one in and put them back, and I'll be resetting them individually. So I'm mixing this up as we go. Now, I just mentioned, what if both of them come when they're not supposed to? So I praise the one that was supposed to come, ignoring the other one, and a lot of times they're trying to get in there on that praise, right? And I just ignore them. I just kind of push them away, praise this one, and then I tell this one, okay, you know, it's good, go, good, go, good, go. It's over, seats, good seats. And now I turn my attention to the one that broke the position that wasn't supposed to, and I go, phooey that, with a light correction to start. I walk them back to where they were supposed to be. I put them back in the same position they were supposed to be in, and then I start the exercise again. Typically, the first couple times, I'll put them back. I'll walk back to the dog that was still staying there because I just called them in. They're still in their sit. Praise them again. Good sit. Good wait. And then I'll call the other dog to me and praise them. I don't want to have too many negative in a row with the dogs. But if they're struggling, if the one keeps breaking, then I close distance. I get closer to them and I do it again, right? Also watch your tone. If you're too excited when you're calling the one dog and the other dog's breaking and running to you, that can be a problem. Calm your tone down so that you're not enticing that dog out of position quite as much. If you are struggling with this and then you get a success, make sure you praise the dog for waiting. So it would sound something like, killer, wait. Princess, let's go. Good, go, good, go. Killer, good, wait, killer. Princess comes in, praise, praise, praise. Kind of calm and quiet, but let her know she did a good job. Seats, wait. Walk over to killer. Oh, good, wait, killer, good, wait. Atta boy, you did so good. And see, she hears me calling, and she thinks she's supposed to come to me too. So as you go through that, that's the process you follow. Okay, so we start on the tables, we start close, we start with basic sit, lay down, then we move away from the table a little bit as we go, and we still want them to respond by name, then we put them on the ground, and we start creating some distance, and I'll still be putting sit and lay down exercises in there, but now I start doing recalls to me. You can do recalls up on the table too, just make sure that you have them separated enough that their leads aren't catching on each other and pulling each other off the tables, right? But that's the progression that we follow, then we keep creating distance, we keep creating more complexity in the command sets that we're giving, and we let the dogs develop that way as we go. All right, so if that's been helpful for you and you would like to find more information about dog training from us, check out Canine Academy. You can go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. That's Jack Spirko's website. Click on the Canine Academy banner up there on the right side of the page, I believe it is, and he'll get credit for that, and then you can check out our basic, intermediate, and advanced courses. If you have any questions, feel free to email me, Joel, J-O-E-L, at fortresscanine.com, and if you're looking for a working line puppy, a fully obedience-trained dog, or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. You can click on the consult button there, and we will set up a time to communicate with you, answer all of your questions, and see if what we have to offer is something that's going to fit well into your lifestyle. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Good stuff from Joel. Now let's talk about learning as a lifelong learner. You know, that's a concept that I have hammered into this audience for 17 years of doing this show now, that we are here to do only a few things, actually, on this planet, I believe. Because I also believe in giant umbrella terms to simplify an explanation of things. I really think, like Richard Bach summed it up perfectly in his book Illusions, the purpose of life is to learn and have fun. And if you learn and have fun, all the other things you're worried about, like impacting others for the positive, making the world a better place, that will all happen. That will all happen. You will not learn and have fun and be an evil person. Right? I mean, you might think, Mr. Burns, yeah, excellent. No, that's not how life really works. If you're a decent person and your main objectives on this trip we call life are learn and have fun, you will positively impact the world. And if that's too much freedom for you, I don't know, maybe Patrick can explain it a little bit better than me.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's Expert Council segment of the week. Today we're going to talk about sharpening. When you sharpen a knife, it doesn't get sharp just with a single pass on the stone. And just like sharpening a knife, we have to hone our sharpening skills. It requires time, it requires practice, and it takes patience. You don't learn about sharpening simply by reading an article or watching a video. You learn by actually doing it. You learn by putting in the repetitions, and the way that the knife feels on the stone, the way that the knife sounds on the stone, getting your body in tune and used to the movements of sharpening. And it comes over years of practice. Now, I don't want to discourage you, because when we look at what it takes to become proficient at any skill, it's easy to get discouraged and think, I can't do that. But who doesn't have 5 or 10 minutes to sit down and practice any skill once, twice, 3, 4 times a week? And before you know it, you're going to be far better off. After a while, the years will go by and you'll realize how simple sharpening is. Most people don't want to put in the work. They see it. It's easier just to say, well, I can't do that, and never actually try. Sharpening is a skill, and even myself, I am constantly learning. I'm constantly trying new things, and it's interesting with any skill. The better you become, the more critical you are of your results. So I don't know about you, but what I found in life is the better I become at something, the more I see room for improvement and room for, like, you see just kind of how bad you are at, you know, the little things. And it's kind of a funny thing, because I was talking to a friend on the phone, and you know, we were talking about running, and I'm a very slow runner. He, in my opinion, is a very fast runner. And he was talking about how, you know, he needs to work on his speed. And it's just kind of comical when you're talking to somebody, how we see ourselves versus how other people see us. And so for a lot of people, they might be surprised for me to say that I'm not very good, or I see like where I'm not very good at sharpening. And even though I can get a knife sharper than a lot of people out there, I still know where I struggle and where I have problems with it. And it's over the years that you start learning. And the other thing about it is, too, the minute you stop practicing, you start losing the skill. So just like with my running, if I stopped running for a month or two, you're surprised at how quickly that skill diminishes. So the more we practice a skill, the better we're going to get. And it's something that you can do. It takes patience. It takes practice. And I encourage you to get out there, learn a new skill, put in the time, and it won't be long and you'll be doing far better than the average person. It doesn't take much nowadays to stand out. You know, a little bit of work can really take you a long ways. So keep in mind, sharpening is not about just this one time you're sitting down to sharpen a knife. It's a habit that you're going to, every time you return to your sharpening stone and you put in some practice, you're refining your skill, you're getting better. I hope you found this information helpful. I appreciate your time. If you have any questions, feel free to send them to me, patrick@mtknives.net, and we'll see you next time. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Now let's talk about rehabbing an older, kind of worse for the wear, solar power backup system with Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSP community, this is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today I've got a question from Kent, who is writing in to ask about ways to use a very old solar generator. So this was before we were calling them solar generators. He had something called a Solar Max 5300, which back in 2015 when this was made, it was a pretty interesting system, but it was kind of Frankenstein, to be honest. I did find a YouTube video describing it, but it doesn't show all the components. Most of the data sheets that are supposed to be online are no longer online. So this system is very difficult to find information for, but I can give you a bit of information, Kent, and then I'm actually going to go into some alternative uses, and hopefully this segment can actually be helpful for more than just Kent with his specific use case. So first of all, one thing that I did find is that the system uses absorbed glass mat batteries. So common nomenclature for these is AGM batteries, and they have largely fallen out of favor for the more common LiFePO4 batteries. But because of the system that you have, I wouldn't recommend putting in any type of different battery. I would use an AGM battery. Now, there is a company that is still making these and still using these fairly regularly, and they seem to be fairly high quality, and that company is Renogy. I will include a link for Jack to include in the show notes. I'll also include a link for the YouTube video that I found describing this system. These batteries are about $180 for a 100 amp hour battery, and Kent, I would probably say you need at least two of these to make your system operate properly. But I would like to caution you not to delve too far into the sunken cost fallacy. I know this system was really expensive when you bought it, but solar has come a long ways. Battery technology, inverters, all have come a long ways since this system was built. And if you really wanted to go fully into restoring the system to 100% of what it was by getting enough batteries, you will probably cost yourself more than it would cost to get a much higher quality system and start fresh. So the next thing that Kent asked about is alternative uses, because the system has quite a few interesting different devices and pieces that he could potentially use. What I will say is my comment before about it being a kind of a Frankenstein system, there's some really questionable connections, according to the video, as far as how the solar panels were being connected to the system. So I would actually, if I were to use this system, or if I were to use parts and pieces of it, I would abandon the charge controller and the batteries, but the solar panels can be reused and the inverters can be reused. So let's start there with some alternatives. First of all, you could use the inverters for a Harris-style car inverter system, or basically a backup system. One tweak I would make to this is I would connect a second battery with the inverter, and I would have that battery charge off of the alternator for the car on a switched disconnect. So meaning it should be on a fused system that shuts off when the ignition is shut off for the vehicle, so that you don't use the inverter and drain down the main battery for the vehicle. Not only will it damage the lead acid battery, it could cause issues with you not being able to start your car. So in that circumstance, I would use a smaller LiFePO4 battery, because most of them, as long as they have a battery management system, will want to charge up to right around that 14 volts that a car alternator will charge to. So they're about perfect for this circumstance. So you get a smaller LiFePO4 battery, like a 20 amp hour, maybe at largest 100 amp hour, and then you hook one of these inverters to that system on a switch disconnect on the ignition system for your car. Another alternative is to pull the inverters for uses in like sheds or outbuildings. So you could set them up in a small outbuilding to do things like charge up power tools, or to run lights, or to run other small devices. Your large inverter is a non-sine wave inverter, and those can do damage to quite a few different things. I would encourage you to just do your research on what should and should not be run on a non-sine wave inverter. Your small inverter, your 300-watt inverter, could be used for just about anything that's under about 200 watts. You really don't want to push the inverter up to 300 watts consistently, but you could basically decentralize these, use the two inverters in different buildings with small LiFePO4 batteries, a inexpensive charge controller, and one or two of each of these panels. You could break those off and decentralize them. You could also use these panels for smaller direct solar applications. So an example would be right outside of the office where I'm recording this, I have a rabbit hutch. I've taken one of my solar panels, put it on top of that hutch, and what it's doing is it's actually shading the hutch from getting as hot. It's shading the roof from getting as hot. And then it's also connected to a 13.8 volt 10 amp buck converter, which then runs a couple of computer fans. And my rabbits absolutely love those computer fans. They spend most of the day sitting in front of them, getting that nice breeze, also being cooler because the solar panel is function stacked as an additional shade to my roof. So you can do that with a rabbit hutch. You can do something similar with a chicken coop, where basically you use the direct solar as a fan system to ventilate your chicken coop. You can do the same thing for a small shed to keep it from getting too hot using direct solar as a venting system. A couple other ideas are you can use these solar panels with either a charge controller or a 13.8 volt buck converter at vehicle locations. So if you've got a tractor, a UTV, something that you want to keep topped off when you're not using it, one of these panels would definitely be overkill, but it would do a great job keeping your batteries on remote vehicles topped off and ready to use. One last thing that Kent mentioned was that he's got a bit of a limited knowledge on the electrical solar realm, and I was wondering if people might be interested in some expert council segments, basically going through the nomenclature and the kind of 101 basics of what the different parts of a solar system are, how they get connected, and what some of the nomenclature is, so that when you start looking into it, you have a bit of a head start. So let me know if you're interested in that. And as always, you can find my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com.
And I do have four different links that he sent with that segment in the show notes today. Again, the episode is 3745. If you find Ryan's bullet point, which is like the fifth one down, you'll see four sub-bullets, each hyperlinked over to a YouTube video and some of the products like the batteries he recommended. Next up, though, we're going to talk about something called a parasite cleanse with Doc Bones. I mean, I haven't listened to this one yet. I didn't pre-screen it. I'm interested in what Bones has to say about this, because I have mixed feelings on this one, and I will reserve my feelings until I hear what Bones has to say.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the greatly expanded fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert council comes from Chuck, who writes, what's the correct process, prep and items, and medicine to purchase for a parasite cleanse? We've been researching what other countries do for their health, and it seems that once a year they do a parasite cleanse. We are a family of four. Both adults are in their upper 30s, and kids are age 2 and 5. Thanks, Chuck. Chuck, by the way, is a listener since 2013. Wow. Thanks, Chuck. For those who don't know, a parasite cleanse is a type of detox regimen. It's comprised of dietary supplements and dietary changes intended to rid the body of, well, parasites. A cleanse usually involves taking herbal supplements such as wormwood, black walnut, clove oil, while also following a diet that restricts processed foods, sugar, and alcohol. Some versions may also include foods like garlic, pumpkin seeds, and even probiotics and antibiotics like ivermectin. Advocates for parasite cleanses on social media like TikTok suggest they can alleviate symptoms like bloating, fatigue, or unexplained weight changes by flushing out these parasites, which are considered a type of poison. Well, first, let me say that parasite and parasite infections are indeed a thing. They affect more than 3 billion people a year globally and cause about 200,000 deaths. But a good question to ask you, Chuck, is where do you live? Like you say, they're common in some places, but uncommon in developed countries with decent sanitation, like the United States. When might you suspect a parasite infection? Symptoms like gas, diarrhea, or muscle aches can be seen in parasite infections, and so something to look for there. But then again, they're more likely to occur due to more common issues like irritable bowel syndrome, dietary problems, or stress. What people mistake for worms in their stool during cleanses sometimes is just mucus or undigested fibers, say from psyllium, or intestinal linings left off by the laxative effect of certain herbs. Still, testing can identify many parasites, which are then treated with antibiotics like ivermectin or metronidazole. Some natural compounds like wormwood or garlic extracts show promise in lab studies against specific parasites, but the hard data on a lot of other herbal supplements is just not there yet. Probiotics, vitamin A, zinc, or selenium may offer some support against parasite infection. If you live in a high-risk worm area, deworming with proven meds every 6 months is actually considered to be more effective than frequent parasite cleanses. And why is that? Well, first, as I mentioned before, a lot of these products don't have enough hard data to prove them superior to ivermectin and other anti-parasite meds used after testing. And they may also unbalance your gut microbiome, which is very important. Parasite cleanses do come with some risks. Besides messing with good intestinal bacteria, they may cause diarrhea, nausea, dehydration, or electrolyte imbalances from laxative herbs. Other herbs like wormwood may cause liver toxicity or interact with medicines you might already be taking. So what should you do? Well, you want to support your gut health holistically by eating fiber-rich foods. Veggies like broccoli and beets, garlic, onions, fermented items like yogurt, these promote beneficial bacteria. You want to stay hydrated. Aim for 8 or more glasses of water a day. Avoid triggers. Cut ultra-processed foods, processed sugars, and alcohol, which can feed those bad gut bugs. And consider sticking with probiotics, vitamin A, zinc, or selenium for immunity. Parasite cleanses may be useful in some circumstances, but if you live in an area with access to testing, best to check it out first before taking the plunge. Your body already has billions of good microbes. Don't mess with the balance without good reason. Having said that, the off-grid medic would be wise to stock some ivermectin and metronidazole as part of their survival medicine cabinet. For more information, make sure to check out our website at doomandbloom.net and use the search engine to check out parasitic worms or parasites. This is Joel and MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, do an old country doctor and your family a favor by getting medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, so I think Bones and I are kind of in the same place, but maybe I'll be a little more direct. I think most of what you're hearing on the TV and social media right now is a fucking scam. I don't even think we would be talking about this if the latest marketing craze in herbal supplements, etc., wasn't parasite cleanses. It's on Fox News. It's on the TV all over the place. It's all over social media. I heard my wife listen to one of these things. Yeah, parasite cleanses. That's what they do in Vietnam. Yeah, they also walk in their own shit in the rice paddies. Okay? Kind of what Bones alluded to. Now, can parasites be a problem for the human? Sure. But you probably don't have any. And what we have right now is a society where every ill has a pill, right? That's a rhyme. I didn't even plan it, right? But every ill has a pill. And so the thing that people are doing when they step outside pharmaceutical is something I've talked about for years. I call it pharmaceutical replacement therapy. And it is not how to use herbal supplements at all. And what I mean by that is the concept of, like, so since I have a headache, and aspirin works for a headache, and since one of the main ingredients in aspirin is also in willow, if I use white willow bark as a supplement for my headache, then I can fix my headache without using a pharmaceutical. And there are places for pharmaceuticals or herbs that are replacement of there, right? But a headache is not a symptom of an aspirin deficiency. And herbal and natural remedies should be about restoring the body's balance. Something's out of balance, so we need to figure it out. And the herbs are not really the solution. They are providing support during the initiation of the solution, right? That's herbal medicine. That's alternative health practitioner medicine. when you look at something like this parasite cleanse, what you're doing is saying instead of using a pharmaceutical like ivermectin, which would, by the way, be perfect for this if you actually had a parasitic infection, but they can't just sell you ivermectin and call it parasite cleanse because it's a prescription medication. So we'll put together these herbs that are anti-parasitic. I'm not saying they don't do what they say they do. I'm saying you don't have the problem that there's, like, if you have a parasite, you should be able to like test for that parasite and see that you actually are infected with that parasite. And most Americans today, your problem isn't a parasite, it's your diet, just to be blunt. And I won't get into lecturing on what you should or shouldn't be eating, but most Americans today that have health problems, where it's achy joints, whether it's type 2 diabetes, or, you know, all the things generally go down to diet. And generally, most Americans today who are not healthy from a standpoint of like they feel good are also obese, which is directly connected to your diet, no matter what anybody ever tells you. So fix the diet and the lifestyle and worry less about the parasites unless you have conclusive symptoms that are indicative of parasitic infection. All right, that's my two cents on that. Let's talk about what do you do with your garden. You're heading into winter. Old man winter is like, I ain't there yet, boys, but I'm on the way. And the fall is here, right? Like, it's hard to accept that there's fall here in Texas unless you're in the mornings or the evenings. Because the middle of the day still feels a hell of a lot like summer in, let's say, Virginia. Okay? But it is. And it will come fast. And what's happening right now, and you can see it every day, is it gets dark earlier, right? We are heading into that definite shortening of the days. I find myself looking out the window right now and going, what time is it? It's 6:45? It ain't dark yet, but you know what I mean. Like, it does not look like 6:45. It looks like, you know, 8:15, not 6:45. Like, it looks like it's an hour 15, hour and a half later in the day than it was just a few months ago. Because it is. It's just how it works. So we know it's coming. So you got the garden. What do you do now? Like, or what do you do between now and, let's say, Thanksgiving, Christmas? Okay. I'm going to give you a very high-level kind of macro view of this just to kind of reiterate all the things you need to think about. These are not necessarily in order. The order sort of kind of works, but it may change based on decisions you're making, right? And when you do certain things will have to do with what you're going to do. In other words, if you're going to have a garden all the way into winter, and then maybe you're going to shut it down after Christmas when the first big, heavy super frost hits or something, it's going to be different. If you plan on doing the things that I say starting now, then you're going to initiate where you might not start with the first step of harvest everything for another few weeks or another month, depending on what your schedule is. So just to be clear on that, this is for people who do not plan to garden through the winter, but want to be ready to go and better next year than they are right now. They actually want to start the next year in a better position than they ended the last one. All right, so first of all, is harvest everything. We should be harvesting everything before we go into, like, that is kind of like your first step. It's kind of the first place you need to be. And that way nothing gets wasted. So this is going to go out, pick all the peppers, pick all the tomatoes, and figure out the things that you harvest that maybe are not optimally ripe yet. Like a tomato, you just put it somewhere where it can finish ripening. Some other things, maybe you go ahead and you do something with them before they're fully ripe. Or, you know, like select your stuff if you haven't yet for seed saving. But one way or another, harvest everything and either eat it, preserve it, feed the chickens, compost it, but you gotta get it all harvested. Then you want to terminate your crops. This I'll leave up to you, but your plants need to go to the ground one way or another, whether it's cutting them off and leaving the roots in the ground, whether for you that's pulling plants up and dropping them, whether you remove them and compost them or remove them and burn them, whatever you do, get the garden level. I had so much weed growth because I quit this year, and so much grass grown in this year, that what I did is pulled up all my irrigation out of the way, got my weed flamer and flamed it all, and then kind of pushed everything from the flames toward the center because a lot of it was green and didn't really burn, and then 2 days later went back and did it a second time, right? I don't care if you crimp terminate, I don't care what you do, but you don't want to have your plants still standing, unless you're going to do an integrated cover crop and leave your crops go and kind of grow up underneath them. right? That's something I cover in my course. We'll get there in just a second. The next thing is protect and prepare your perennials. Now, I'm not talking about your fruit trees, even though, yes, they're perennial, or your roses or whatever. But like, if you have an integrated garden where you have certain perennials, like certain perennial herbs, you want to make sure that, you know, even if you don't do this right out of the gate, maybe you're going to do your cover crop first or whatever, but you need to have a plan that at some point, like that oregano that comes back every year, like there's extra mulch on top of it, especially if you're like in a more northern climate, there's a good chance it, with a really hard winter, even though it's a perennial, it could die. And if you give it that extra protection, or a lot of people tend to grow within their garden, their true production garden space, things like cane fruits, like blackberries and raspberries. Those need pruning back. Now, again, like I said, this is not necessarily in order, depending on what time of the year you're in, where you're at. Like, if you're going to start this in a month, it might be different than if you start it now, that type of thing. But generally speaking, your cane fruits, your second-year canes all need to be pruned out, and your first-year canes tip back to the height you want them to fruit next year, and they'll be second-year canes that fruit for you. Or anything else like that. Anything that you have integrated into your garden, I'm including in this. Whatever maintenance it needs at the end of the year. Sometimes the maintenance is better done in true winter when everything's dead. It's up to you, but at one way or another, get those perennials protected, and any maintenance, any pruning, anything that needs doing to them as they go dormant for the winter. Then you also want to add, this is a great time to add fertility, especially once you've done all the things I just said. And that may or may not include your perennials, but when you have taken all the annuals to the ground, and you're getting ready to either tarp or cover crop that we'll get to in a minute, okay? This is the time to add your compost, like a couple inches deep compost everywhere on top of your garden, your organic fertilizer, mulch, nutrients, rock dust, whatever it is you're going to do. Now, I'll give you some things I like to do. I'll give you exactly what I'm doing this year. Again, I burned everything off. I have one more garden bed that needs a second burn. I'll get that done. Once that's done, I'm going to go in and I'm going to put down a covering thin layer of biochar this year. Like, I'm going to go heavy on the biochar. Now, it's all naked char, but it has until next spring to be ready. On top of it is going a nice amount of Dr. Earth fertilizer. Okay? And what that's going to do is that is going to serve as the inoculum for it. And then what's going down is I have a bag of kind of moldy old duck food, and I'm going to break that up since I have four big gardens into fourths, and I'm going to spread. That's worm food. That's worm food. So that's going to go down. Then I'm going to take a big handful of worms out of the worm farm and add them to each bed because it's cool enough now the worms will be happy. And that will infuse even more worms than are already in there, add new worm blood, right? And once I get that done, then I'm going to put down my super high-end compost that I make, my bioreactor compost. Once that's done, then I'm going to seed my cover crop and press it into the compost, and I'm going to mulch over with about an inch deep of fresh wood mulch, Ramial wood chips, which means wood chips that are mixed different trees, leaves, needles, all of it together mixed. I'm doing that because I just got another like 20 yards of it dumped in my field. So I've got beautiful fresh wood chips to do that with. That will be then the genesis of the cover crop. When you guys get here that are coming to the workshop, you'll be able to see the cover crop with about 3.5-4 weeks of growth behind it. And you'll see what it looks like. So I'm going to cover crop. And that's what I'm going to do. But that's what I'm going to do for the fertility and mulch heavy. And if you're not cover cropping, mulch even heavier. Right, the reason I'm going to mulch with about, you know, an inch and a half of mulch is because I want the cover crop to be able to get up relatively quickly. But if I was not putting down a cover crop, I'd throw 3 to 4 inches of wood chips on it right now and just let it rot all through the winter and get into this really great shape. Then you're either going to what you want to do next is gild out. You do not want to, in March or April, be out there with a shovel turning over big, giant clods of weed. So I'm going to call it either tarp it or cover crop it. And I don't care what you do, one of those will cover it. You're either going to use a organic solution to keep growth that you don't want from happening in late fall into winter and early spring before you're ready to plant, which would be a cover crop, or you're going to tarp it. And I don't care if you put down pieces of freaking wood. I don't care what you put down. To me, you're tarping it. either use a synthetic or organic method to prevent unwanted growth through your winter season. Okay? Then you want to winterize your irrigation, whatever that means for you. For me, it really doesn't mean that much, right? I don't have the harsh winters that some of you guys do. But whatever that means to you, you need to do it, right? If you have water that goes out to your garden and you have stand-ups out there, hopefully you have a cutoff where you don't have to cut off the water to everywhere on your property. Maybe you cut that off and blow those pipes out, right? Whatever is necessary for any type of irrigation or any other mechanical systems, time systems, things that you won't be using, put that to bed for the winter. Then you want to set out, this is like a little extra step, but it makes a lot of sense. Set out feeders and maybe even some sort of source of water for your birds through your winter. Bring lots of birds to your garden area. They will pick on any pests that show up. They'll also give you free fertility. They'll hop around in your gardens. They'll enjoy their life. And this is something that people don't realize how much you can do to improve bird habitat, is to provide them some source of water, especially when everything's frozen. That might even mean that every day you go out and you have some sort of water, like a bird bath. And just take a gallon of warm kitchen water out there with you. Just out of the sink, just out of the hot side, and dump it on top. And, like, it'll melt the ice or what have you. Or if you use even, you could go as far as using, like, one of the things that keep chicken waterers from freezing up and put some sort of something out there for them. But what we've noticed is we have this beautiful little, I call it a mini Miyagi that I built for Dorothy. It's about 4 foot by 4 foot, roughly, made out of 4x4s. It stands about 30 inches tall. We bought a stone bowl, like for a bowl sink, like a stone carved bowl sink off Etsy. I put that in the center up on top of a platform, and the water comes up through the bottom and spills over the sides. Put all kinds of water plants in it, threw goldfish in it so we don't have any mosquitoes, and she loves it. And it's supposed to be a bird bath. And all summer long, birds hardly ever use it. And the reason is simple. There's water. They can go find water. There's all kinds of places they can find water. In the winter, because it's on a pump and it will stay not frozen, except in the most extreme winter conditions for us, there's birds in there like crazy. And the colder it gets, if we can keep it going, and the more frozen everything else is, the more birds come. So do things for your birds in the winter, because they actually need it a lot more than the summer and the spring and the fall. We do that for us, so we can watch the birds and be happy. We don't really do it for the birds that time of year. The time they need it is a time of scarcity, and that will make your bird friends more friendly, including your year-round bird friends, will be more likely to set up shop and provide you pest overwatch going into your next season. Then clean, put away, and do maintenance on your tools, organize things, stuff like that. This is things like clean up the shovels, put a little bit of oil on them, put some linseed oil on the handles. This is things like take, you know, your irrigation, I said to go ahead and winterize that, but like your hose nozzles, anything like that, put them away for the year. Anything that you normally kind of have right there because you use it a lot that you don't use during this time period, get a bin, a box, something. Put everything in there and stick it in one place. And that way in the spring, when you're ready to reboot things and keep going, you can go right there and boom, it's all there because you put it there. If you do not do this, then you are not going to enjoy your March or your late February or your early April, whatever time of year it is for you. I promise the things that you said, well, I just left it there. It'll either be broke, ruined by the weather, disappeared, carried off, forgotten about, you said it was there, but it wasn't there, it won't be where you want it when you want it, or when you find it, it won't work, it'll be broken. So take this time now to do those things. So again, harvest everything, terminate your crops, protect your perennials, prune back plants that need it like berries, add fertility like compost, organic fertilizer, mulch, nutrient, rock dust, etc. Mulch heavily, gild out your weed growth either with tarp or cover crop, winterize your irrigation, set out your feeders and waterers for your birds through the winter to support them, clean, put away, do maintenance on, organize your tools. As always, if you want to know how to do cover cropping just like a rock star for your backyard, then we have a cover crop course available at homefoodsystems.com. And if you want to know how to make the best compost on planet Earth, and I will stand on that, I will die on that hill, the compost that we make with bioreactors is the best compost, period, made on the planet. I'm not saying no one nowhere makes it. As a method, for consistently producing super high quality compost. Nothing beats a bioreactor. You can take that course also at homefoodsystems.com. That course is $40. The cover crop course is $80. You'll learn more about soils in those two courses combined than you will in a $5,000 course from Elaine Ingham. I don't say that lightly. I say that because Billy Bond, who paid for the Elaine Ingham course, said, of what matters, I learned more in your course than I learned in that course about what really matters to soil, compost, nutrition. So that's pretty high praise from Billy Bond. With that, I have wrapped things up. And if you want to help support us, again, you can always join the Members Support Brigade. If you do that, just go to survivalpodcast.com, click on Members to learn more. And again, you'll get great discounts that will more than cover the cost of your membership. I just mentioned the cover crop course and the compost course. There's discounts on both of those for MSB members. Also, remember, you can help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. The Streamlight Pro Tac Dual Fuel Tac Light is on sale right now for 25% off. There's some other really cool stuff that's available right now, knocked down. All of the things for this week are in the show notes for today's episode. If you want to find those, just go to the site, look for episode 3745. If you're listening to this sometime in the distant future, some of those sale prices may be gone, but the products will still be solid. With that, I will catch you on Monday with a brand new episode. Have a great weekend. Make the most out of it. Remember what Patrick said about learning. You know, that it's something that you have your whole life to do, so be patient. But at the same time, get started now. But that's everything. It's not just learning. Building your business, building your life, you know, improving your homestead, improving your system, designing your life, whatever it is. You have your whole life to do it, but time is still finite. So be patient, be practical, be prudent, but also be a little bit aggressive. Take care, guys. I'll catch you Monday.
You should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.